Christina Menenti with your worldwide news update. Hamas's plans to delay the release of three more hostages and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's threat to call off the ceasefire is causing anguish among Palestinians and Israelis alike. AP correspondent Mimi Montgomery reports.
It comes after Hamas said it plans to delay the release of three more hostages as they accuse Israel of failing to meet ceasefire terms, including by not allowing an agreed-upon number of tents and aid into Gaza. Families of hostages taken by Hamas say the militant group's plan to delay came as a shock. Herut Nimrodi, mother of Tamir Nimrodi, a kidnapped Israeli soldier, reacts.
We want to believe that both sides and the mediators can sit down and solve this issue.
I'm Mimi Montgomery.
U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is on his first trip to NATO, where allies are eager to learn how much military and financial support Washington intends to provide Ukraine. Hegseth held talks on Wednesday with U.K. Defense Secretary John Healey before meeting of the Ukraine Defense Contact Group at NATO headquarters in Brussels. Russia released imprisoned American Mark Fogel in what the U.S. is calling a step towards the end of Ukraine's war. AP correspondent Ed Donahue reports.
The history teacher from Pennsylvania was deemed wrongfully detained.
I feel like the luckiest man on earth right now.
Fogel appeared at the White House alongside President Trump. An American flag was draped around his shoulders. Fogel was arrested in 2021. His family says he had been traveling with medically prescribed marijuana. President Trump did not say if he talked with Russian President Vladimir Putin, but said Fogel's pardon was fair and reasonable and could lead to other developments.
You could be a big part of it, actually, because it could be a big, important part of getting the war over with Ukraine.
Fogel's relatives say they're beyond grateful, relieved, and overwhelmed that he is coming home. Ed Donahue, Washington.
This is VOA News. Elon Musk has made a public defense of his Department of Government Efficiency. AP correspondent Ben Thomas has more.
Elon Musk made a rare public appearance at the White House Tuesday as President Trump signed an executive order to continue downsizing the federal workforce. Musk telling reporters,
"It's not optional for us to reduce the federal expenses. It's essential."
As for criticism that he's mounting a hostile takeover of the government, he said DOGE has a strong mandate.
"The president spoke about that at every rally. The people voted for major government reform. And that's what people are going to get. They're going to get what they voted for."
Along with large-scale reductions in force, the order calls for agencies to hire no more than one employee for every four that leave. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Donald Trump's trade advisors were finalizing plans on Wednesday for the reciprocal tariffs the U.S. president has vowed to impose on every country that charges duties on U.S. imports, ratcheting up fears of a widening global trade war. Trump stunned markets with his decision on Monday to impose tariffs on all steel and aluminum imports beginning on March 12th. The plan drew condemnation from Mexico, Canada, and the European Union, while Japan and Australia said they were seeking exemptions from the duties. Separately, trade ministers of the European Union were due to meet later by video conference to determine their response after European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said tariff moves against the bloc would, quote, not go unanswered.
Among our key findings, there are reasonable grounds to believe that officials of the former government, its security and intelligence apparatus, together with violent elements associated with the former ruling party, committed serious and systematic human rights violations.
UN Human Rights High Commissioner Volker Turk said on Wednesday that there were reasonable grounds to believe that certain crimes against humanity were committed by Bangladesh's former government. Before Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina was toppled in a student-led revolution last August, her government cracked down on protesters and others, including, quote, hundreds of extrajudicial killings. The United Nations said Hasina, who fled into exile in neighboring India, has already defied an arrest warrant to face trial in Bangladesh for crimes against humanity. Romania's President Klaus Iohannis has resigned a day before he faced an impeachment vote sparked by the cancellation of the country's presidential election last year. That came after the far-right populist Calling Georgescu unexpectedly won the first round as allegations emerged of Russian interference and electoral violations. Quote, "To spare Romania from this crisis, I am resigning as president of Romania," unquote. Clashes broke out between Georgescu supporters and police in front of the government building in the capital, Bucharest, and tear gas was used to disperse protesters. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Christina Menenti, VOA News.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News tonight.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This signals the beginning of a timeline for a transition to a democratically elected government in the Republic of Niger.
That's Ibrahim Farouk, Program Coordinator for the Africa Division of YAGA Africa. Details coming up. Also, the Ugandan former presidential candidate Kizza Besigye has gone on hunger strike. And President Donald Trump is doubling down on his demand that Jordan's King Abdullah II support his plan to take over Gaza. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Fighting has erupted Tuesday in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo after a two-day lull with the M23 fighters attacking positions of the Congolese armed forces in South Kivu province at dawn. A few days ago, leaders from Eastern and Southern Africa called for an immediate and unconditional ceasefire, fearing the conflict, which has killed thousands and driven vast numbers from their homes, would spill over into neighboring countries. David Monda, professor of political science at the City University of New York, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi the concerns the fighting could expand.
I think it's definitely a major concern, but I think a lot of the regional players in saying they don't want to spill over also need to appreciate that they are also very actively involved in supporting the different belligerents, whether it's the FDLR behind the DRC government and FDLR or the M23 and, and Rwanda. So it definitely can spill over to become a regional conflict, but I think it already is. If you think of the humanitarian situation, so many refugees have moved over into Rwanda right now, and there's a problem at the borders. The troops are moving further south, M23, into Kavumbu. But I think the spillover is already there, particularly in humanitarian elements of this conflict.
The M23, which claims to protect ethnic Tutsis, began advancing in South Kivu after late last month taking control of Goma. The anti-government group has begun setting up its own administration in Goma, a city of 1 million people, launching recruitment campaigns, including to create a police force. What do you make of that?
I think they're trying to consolidate their position as the M23, as an alternative government, in Goma. That's a very strategic move because we know most of the relief operations in and out of the eastern DRC are centered in Goma. So that's a big, big advantage for the M23. I think they're also using it as a bargaining tool because once the M23 establishes its own autonomous government separate from Kinshasa, in Goma, at the negotiating table, I think they'll have a much stronger hand because they'll be able to force the Tshisekedi government into an even tighter corner. But I also must add that the M23 rebels, they're establishing this new administration also in light of the warrant of arrest that was passed on the rebel Colonel Nanga. I think that escalates this conflict even further. So the M23 are not incentivized to negotiate because their leader is going to be captured and a lot of them would be accused of crimes against humanity. So I think that's another level of the complexity of this fighting, where it looks like it's going to get worse and the rebels are going to try and take as much territory as they can as, using war as a tool for diplomacy. And there is ultimately the threat that they might even take up arms and try and overthrow the Tshisekedi administration by going all the way to Kinshasa, very much like in the first Congo War, the rebels did the same and overthrew the regime of Mobutu Sese Seko.
That was David Mondo, professor of political science at the City University of New York, talking to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. Niger is set to hold a national convention to map out its long-awaited political transition following the July 2023 coup that deposed President Mohamed Bazoum. Junta leader General Abdurrahman Chiani says the dialogue will be inclusive, set governance priorities, and determine the transition timeline. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Niger's military announced on state television last Saturday that the national convention will take place from February the 15th to the 19th. Authorities say the meeting is expected to produce a preliminary draft of the transition charter. Junta leader General Abdurrahman Chiani had initially committed to a three-year transition after seizing power from President Mohamed Bazoum in July 2023. But months of silence on the issue filled uncertainty among Nigerians and international observers. Ibrahim Farouk, program coordinator for the African division at YEAGA Africa, says the convention is a step in the right direction.
This signals the beginning of a timeline for a transition to a democratically elected government in the Republic of Niger. I think why this is important is that democratic stability in the West African sub-region has the area of creating a ripple effect. We saw how once there were coups and attempted coups in some of these countries, it caused a ripple effect. But beyond just a return to democratic governments, it must also provide the promise of development that comes with democracy as well.
Ahead of the convention, authorities held consultations across Niger's eight regions and formed a national commission to oversee the dialogue. At the end of the meeting, the commission is expected to submit a final report to Chiani within 3 weeks. The July 2023 coup triggered widespread condemnation, including threats of military intervention from the Regional Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS. Niger's political crisis reflects a broader trend in the Sahel, where military takeovers have become more frequent amid escalating jihadist threats and growing resentment towards civilian governments. Farouk believes Niger could set a positive example.
Mali, the Republic of Niger, and Burkina Faso, who have witnessed unconstitutional changes of government. And I think one common thread that has been running through these three countries is that there hasn't been an adherence to previously agreed transition timelines. But I hope that with this step in the Republic of Niger, it would signal to their brothers in Mali and in Burkina Faso that indeed there is an importance to return back to a democratically elected government.
Mali and Burkina Faso, both under military rule, have extended their transition timelines despite initially pledging a quicker return to democracy. Mali's military attributes the delay to a second coup in 2021, just months after overthrowing President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. Burkina Faso's Junta postponed elections, citing security concerns. Political analyst Ahmed Buhari says a transition plan is a good step, but
it's very important for us as Africans to know that we cannot copy and paste an entire system and expect it to work with a different culture, cultural views, values, and norms. And that is why I think to a large extent we are struggling as a continent to find our stability, economic growth, security, and most importantly, identity for our people. At the same time, different democracies would work for different people around the world. We must create a democratic environment that is suitable for our current realities and challenges.
Critics warn that prolonged military rule remains a strong possibility in the Sahel. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Ugandan former presidential candidate Kizza Besigye has gone on hunger strike months into his detention by authorities after he was snatched from neighboring Kenya. His lawyer told the French news agency AFP that Besigye began his protests on Monday because he feels he has been left with no choice but to go on hunger strike. Besigye was abducted in November and has been facing the death penalty on treason charges and a court-martial, which his wife, UNAIDS Executive Director Winnie Bianaima, has called a sham. He has been awaiting a military trial for 3 months, despite a court ruling in January that was unconstitutional for civilians to be tried in such a court. This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The Horn of Africa has both great economic opportunity and great risk of regional conflict. That's the consequences of several regional experts who spoke this week at an Atlantic Council webinar on the Horn's challenges. Michael Waldamariam, an associate professor at the University of Maryland, just outside Washington, says regional trends are quite worrying. Among the biggest issues is that several nations in the region, especially Sudan and Ethiopia, face political instability and internal conflict. He also notes there continues to be tensions between Ethiopia and its neighbors, Eritrea and Somalia. And he says there are outside factors to consider.
And then just a few other things to flag, right, on top of the internal crises in these states. State interventions from Middle Eastern states, which I think are ratcheting up regional tension. That's an older story. Great power maneuvering and competition. I think the role of Russia is really an interesting story, that one that has sort of revealed itself in recent years. Spillover relatedly from the war in Yemen, I think, is quite significant. And then a whole array of kind of environmental, demographic, macroeconomic crises that are really stressing the region. And then finally, amidst all of these intersecting challenges, a real absence, I think, of regional responses from regional multilaterals, key states. So again, one doesn't like to be gloomy, but it's the region's, I think, in a very difficult situation.
Majid Amin is an adjunct faculty member at Johns Hopkins University in the U.S. state of Maryland and the managing partner in the African Renaissance Ventures, an investment fund. He says, despite the risks, there is an economic opportunity in the region.
Ethiopia just had a managing director of the IMF visit, commemorating some of the very substantial reforms that they've done, freeing the currency, opening up to key sectors, generally a very strong trend line in terms of managing or reforming things that we had been working on for decades, really. It was at the World Bank and IFC were interested to see these reforms, and they're happening now. Somalia, actually, despite the challenges from Al-Shabaab, is actually also performing quite well on its reform program. Somaliland, that part of the, signed the MOU, is also growing as an investment destination, and Djibouti is also doing well. So the dynamics are quite clear. It's the demographics. Africa will have a quarter of the world's population. The majority of working age new youth that come into the working age population are in Africa. The region's digitizing very quickly. I think AI is being more democratized, so that sort of big hurdle of potential sort of two-speed global economy is being addressed. So we like the region. We think there are great opportunities. Obviously, we'll have to wait for Sudan.
Amin, as well as other speakers on the panel, noted that Sudan's war, which has been grinding on for nearly 2 years, remains the biggest risk factor in the region. President Donald Trump is doubling down on his demand that Jordan's King Abdullah II support his plan to take over Gaza and permanently take on the Palestinians. Tuesday's White House meeting came amid a possible collapse of the fragile ceasefire between Hamas and Israel. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widi-Koswara has this report.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip fear the return of war after Hamas's threat to delay the next planned release of Israeli hostages and U.S. President Donald Trump's call to cancel the ceasefire.
We have had enough wars. We began to wish death.
As he hosted Jordan's King Abdullah II at the White House Tuesday, Trump doubled down on his plan to take over Gaza.
I think it's going to be something that's going to be magnificent for the Palestinians. They're going to be in love with it. I did very well with real estate. I can tell you about real estate. They're going to be in love with it.
The Palestinians, along with Jordan, Egypt, and various other countries, have rejected Trump's plan to forcibly relocate an estimated 1.9 million Gaza residents into neighboring countries. But other than saying he would immediately receive 2,000 children in Gaza sick with cancer and other illnesses, King Abdullah declined Trump's invitation to share his counteroffer.
I think we have to keep in mind that there is a plan from Egypt and the Arab countries. We're being invited by Mohammed bin Salman to discussions in Riyadh. I think the point is how do we make this work in a way that is good for everybody?
It's a high-stakes meeting for Abdullah, who must maintain ties with a key ally whom Jordan depends on for foreign assistance. Trump hinted Monday he would withhold aid, but backtracked on Tuesday. Many Jordanians are descendants of displaced Palestinians. If Abdullah supports Trump's plans, it will create major political and economic problems and allow Hamas to enter, says Gaith Al-Omari of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
Hamas could create not only domestic problems in terms of terror, but also there's a fear that Jordan might then become a staging ground for attacks on Israel. All of these things will create very, very severe threats to Jordan's stability and maybe even survival.
Al-Omari said Trump's takeover plan removes the incentive for Hamas to continue the ceasefire. On Monday, the U.S.-designated terror group threatened to delay the next planned release of hostages, alleging Israeli truce violations. Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu responded with the same ultimatum.
The decision I passed unanimously in the cabinet is this. If Hamas does not return our hostages by Saturday noon, the ceasefire will end and the IDF will return to intense fighting until Hamas is finally defeated.
Israel will hand over Gaza to the U.S. after the war, Trump has said.
We're not going to buy anything. We're going to have it, and we're going to keep it, and we're going to make sure that there's going to be peace, and there's not going to be any problem, and nobody's going to question it.
These Gazans would disagree. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
Democratic lawmakers are criticizing what they call the Trump administration's extreme efforts to reshape the U.S. government, vowing to oppose those changes despite limited political capital in both chambers of the U.S. Congress. Republicans, however, defend the moves, saying attempts to stop fraud and waste are long overdue. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports from Washington.
A second week of protests from Democratic lawmakers concerned about President Donald Trump's attempts to reshape the U.S. government.
Let us work! Let us work!
Despite limited political capital in both chambers of the U.S. Congress, Democrats vowing to fight what they call the Trump administration's extreme efforts to close down government agencies and immediately lay off federal workers. Chuck Schumer is the top Democrat in the U.S. Senate.
If you want to make cuts, then you do it through a debate in Congress, not lawlessly by just implementing them. We want waste. We want to make sure waste isn't done, but they're cutting out the meat that's going to hurt millions of American families.
Republicans have defended the work of the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, led by billionaire Elon Musk, saying attempts to stop fraud and waste are long overdue. Tom Emmer serves in House Republican leadership.
The Democrat Party's tantrums are exactly why they hold no majority in Congress and their candidate is not in the White House. DOGE is rightly pulling back the curtains that have been closed for years. And the outrage we are seeing across the aisle is baffling but not surprising, given their record of mismanagement of taxpayer dollars.
Democrats are vowing to fight for protections for government agencies or withhold their votes in upcoming government funding talks. Pete Aguilar serves in House Democratic leadership.
There's very little appetite to help Republicans when we don't trust that Donald Trump's going to spend the resources that we've allocated for education, for health care, or even, we don't know, for our own defense. With Elon Musk and his unelected friends running through and combing through the federal system.
Democrats have had some success temporarily stopping Trump's executive orders in the U.S. court system. But one analyst told VOA other changes will take time. Casey Burgat is Legislative Affairs Program Director at the George Washington University.
We haven't yet seen the grassroots mobilization yet, but that's the one most indirect to levers of power within Washington, D.C. It takes time for those messages to resonate with the American people, them to coordinate with each other to gain enough volume to reach members of Congress or enough members of Congress.
But Speaker of the House Mike Johnson said Tuesday the Democratic Party has very little power.
There's no identified leader of the party. They don't have a clear vision. They seem rudderless. In hopes of finding themselves, they've latched onto this new shiny object called the rule of law. Well, we'd like to welcome them to the concept. It would be admirable if they hadn't spent the last 4 years with their heads buried in the sand while Biden literally trampled over the rule of law with no objection.
The short-term agreement funding the U.S. government is set to expire March 14th. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
A Libyan state minister survived an assassination attempt when gunmen opened fire on his car in the capital, Tripoli, today. The Tripoli-based government of national unity strongly condemned the attack. Reuters reports that authorities say an unknown group had shot directly at the vehicle of the state minister for cabinet affairs, Adel Juma, as it traveled on a highway. A governor's statement says Juma's condition is stable and that security authorities have launched investigations to uncover the circumstances of the incident to track down the perpetrators.
Civilians say hundreds of people seeking justice have not been served by the courts all of...
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Douglas Mpuga, and our engineer, Keila Williams, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Africa, I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.